So today we continue in our series on the Beatitudes. The Beatitudes were that amazing poetic beginning that Jesus showed for his very most important sermon really of his life, and that was the Sermon on the Mount. And so as we talked about last week, Jesus gave this powerful lesson on a mountainside overlooking the Sea of Galilee. Actually, by Ozark mountain standards, it's more of a large hill. It really is. I took this picture from about halfway up, and some say that really this lesson should more accurately be called the Sermon on the Mound, because it's a pretty low mountain. Although unnamed at the time of Jesus, today, despite its height, it is referred to as the Mountain of the Beatitudes, and it's still a beautiful sight. And as we said last week, the Beatitudes, admired for their poetic beauty, have been quoted and misquoted, translated and mistranslated, understood and misunderstood for centuries. They really are not about specific rules and rituals. They're eight short, pithy statements about attitudes of being. Jesus is showing us what we need to be in order to align with divine power and absolutely create heaven on earth. Now, once again, our sources for this series are a chapter from Discover the Power Within You, and the chapter is entitled The Amazing Beatitudes, Meditations on the Mount by Reverend Ed Townley, The Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, and an archived, actually it's an audio tape from Charles Roth that is available on truthunity.net. So for those of you who like to know the sources, there they are. So remember last week, we talked about that the word beatitude is from the Latin beatus, which means come to make happy. And here's your test today. How does each one of the beatitudes begin? What are the first two words? What? Blessed are. Absolutely. The beautiful blessed are. Blessed is from the Greek word makarios, which means a self-contained happiness or bliss. A bliss that is from within. And Charles Fillmore tells us that to bless someone means to call upon good, to call forth the very action of God, to call upon God's goodness. Now, Reverend Townley says that Jesus' purpose in beginning his Sermon on the Mount with these short poetic statements is, of course, to get his disciples' attention. That's always the purpose of a lead when you give a talk or write anything. But in Jesus' case, it was also to shock and awaken his disciples into realizing that this message was not going to be the same old religious teaching that they had always known. It was going to be radically different. And in fact, the translators of the Jesus Seminar, some of you may have heard of that, they have a book called The Five Gospels, and in that they highlight this radical spiritual energy that Jesus brought forth with these eight Beatitudes, by changing the word blessed to the more modern and assertive word, congratulations. So we'll try that translation on today for size and see whether we like it or not. I'm going to take a survey next week and ask you, okay, how many like that, okay? But because each of these Beatitudes builds masterfully on the one before, we're going to take a quick look at the ones we looked at last week, and also in case some of you weren't with us. Jesus begins the Sermon on the Mount with, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Now, metaphysically interpreted, we might say that this could mean congratulations to those who are empty of personal pride, open-minded and receptive, for theirs is the full potential of the spiritual realm. And the second one was, blessed are they who mourn, for they will be comforted. This one, we said, could mean congratulations to they who are passionate and eager. That's what the word mourn really meant. Passionate and eager for a personal relationship with the divine, for they will have everlasting strength. That was the true meaning of the word comfort. So we continue today with Jesus' next beatitude, which is, Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Now, this one really seems counterintuitive, does it not? I mean, I looked up a whole bunch of different dictionaries, and here are some synonyms for meek, according to modern dictionaries. Are you ready? Submissive, yielding, obedient, timid, non-assertive, avoiding conflict, silently submitting to authority, soft, spineless, and wimpy. Now I ask you, are these the kind of people who inherit the earth in our society? I don't think so. Are these the ones who become revolutionaries, visionaries, CEOs, and world leaders? Again, usually not. The idea that the weak inherit the earth runs contrary to all our societal norms. Common beliefs are that the squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? Might makes right. And a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. That's what people believe. And can we even imagine this message coming out of the mouth of Jesus, the man who revolutionized religious thought, who blasted the Pharisees and Sadducees at every opportunity, who threw the money changers out of the temple right before Easter, the man who fully and audaciously realized his Christ identity and told us that we could do the same? It does not compute, does it? Obviously. So especially it does not compute when we hear Emmett Fox saying, this beatitude is among the half dozen most important verses in the Bible. He writes, when you understand the spiritual meaning of this teaching, you have the secret of dominion, the secret of overcoming every kind of difficulty. It is literally the key of life. Wow. Well, in order to claim the key today, we're going to look closely at the two significant words in the Beatitude, meek and earth. Now, first of all, I'm going to start with earth. Earth doesn't mean just the globe. It actually means manifestation. In other words, the whole of our outer experience, our outer lives. And the word meek is one of those really pesky mistranslations. Bible scholars tell us that the Greek word was praeus, there's the manifestation piece, it was praeus, a word for which there really is no single synonym. It's derived from a root meaning equilibrium, in full possession, I don't know what's happening with my mic today, in full possession of all the powers of one's meaning. In other words, we might call it inner mastery. That's what meek really means. Harnessing an unrestrained power already possessed. Just as we might harness Niagara Falls to produce electricity, we harness our spiritual powers to navigate our human existence. I think Emmett Fox defines it best. He says, it's a combination of open-mindedness, faith in God, and the realization that divine will is always something joyous and vital, better than anything we could think of in our human minds. So, meekness is the state of mind that surrenders to perfect divine energy and allows divine power to flow. Our actual inner mastery comes from, okay, you ready? LG squared. Anybody guess what that means? Hint, hint, the daily word. Yes, let go and let God. It's exactly right. Let go and let God. When we let go and let God be God in us, we fully use those and harvest those powers that we have. Now, actually, in our human skins, we don't like the word surrender, do we? I mean, it's not a positive word for us. We equate it with defeat, right? Giving up. Yet the beautiful paradox that Jesus presents here is that we inherit the earth. We bring harmony to the outer only when we realize I of myself can do nothing. It is the Christ within that does the work. That's one of my favorite Bible verses. And let's just look at the models of the cycles of nature. Only when fall surrenders to winter can there be a promise of spring. Only when the acorn surrenders its hold on the branch can it start its journey to magnificence. Only when the caterpillar surrenders to the cocoon state can it be transformed into a beautiful butterfly. The Jaffalos write, contrary to popular belief, surrender can be a positive decision. Nothing new can happen until the old loses power. When we surrender, we lose only what is keeping us the same, and we gain everything. So, we might say congratulations to those who surrender to God and their own divine essence, for they will bring harmony to outer experiences. They will become who they are designed to be. And that leads us to the next beatitude, which is, blessed are they, congratulations to those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied. Now, hunger and thirst are two conditions that would have been all too familiar to the people of the ancient Near East. Today, we think we're hungry if we're late for a meal, right? And we think we're thirsty if we forget our companion water bottle. But in Jesus' time, many lived constantly on the edge of starvation and often traveled long distances through dry desert regions with sand filling their nostrils and no water in sight. Those lost in the desert experienced hunger and thirst in a way that most of us, thank goodness, never will. Bible scholars say the words hunger and thirst, as used by Jesus, are actually expressions of strong desire, something we really, really want. And Jesus tells us those who hunger and thirst for what? For righteousness. That's exactly right, for righteousness. So, if I ask you to picture a person, a righteous person, what image pops in your head? Well, someone maybe who lives by a really strict religious code, who goes to church religiously, if you'll pardon the pun, who carries a prayer book under one arm and a Bible under the other, or someone who stands on the street corner preaching or praying like the Pharisees did. Is that what we think righteousness means? Well, this is a far cry from Jesus' concept of righteousness. The word righteousness, as used by Jesus, has nothing to do with actions. It means right thinking. Right thinking. Remember what Jesus said about those Pharisees? He said, surely they already have their reward by standing up and being noticed by everybody. Their ego is fed. And a little later in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, for I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Pretty powerful coming out of Jesus' mouth. And remember, in all the Beatitudes, Jesus is dealing with states of mind, attitudes, not platitudes and not actions. The great truth that Jesus emphasizes in this Beatitude is that we have dominion over our thoughts. Have you ever heard somebody say, well, I can't help what I think, right? Well, if you can't help what you think, who can, right? I mean, it's your mind, it's your intellect. And in Genesis 1:28, which Anne referred to this morning, we read, let humankind dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air, over the cattle and over all the wild animals and every creeping thing on the earth. And many of you will know that in the Bible, birds, wild animals symbolize our thoughts, meaning we are created to have complete dominion over our thinking. The great law of the universe is that which we hold in mind produces its own kind, first in our consciousness and then from all the infinite possibilities in the universe. We draw ourselves to those patterns we hold in mind. And we think rightly when we focus on spiritual truths. This means if we want to bring harmony to some conflict in our lives, we hold thoughts of harmony and peace in our minds. If we want to manifest a physical healing, we mentally focus our attention on wholeness. If we want greater prosperity, we center our thoughts on God as our unfailing source. Fox says, think God thoughts and give your attention to God rather than to the limitation. What is this strategy? What does this sound like? His strategy called what? The golden key, right? That's the golden key. Don't look to the problem, look to God, and look to the, all the powers of the divine. And so in this beatitude, Jesus is saying, congratulations to you who hunger and thirst for right thinking. Happy are you who recognize your oneness with all that is, for your ever-gnawing spiritual hunger will be satisfied. You are unfolding the enfolding Christ. You are coming to live in consciousness that God's goodness is everywhere present and divine order is established in your mind, your body, and affairs. So that's that beatitude. And now the last one we're going to talk about today is, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Well, now at first glance, this one seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it? It seems to lack the paradoxical quality of the others. It seems just to address the spiritual law that what state of mind we hold returns to us in the outer, what we call unity principle number 3. But as usual, Jesus has a deeper meaning. In the original Aramaic, the word mercy was ramka, meaning unconditional love. Loving people the way they are, regardless of who they are, how they are, or where they are. Loving others in spite of their human failures, loving them irrespective of their past actions and current dramas. In other words, loving no matter what. Easier said than done. But of course, this doesn't mean to put up with corrosive negativity. It doesn't mean to condone verbal or physical abuse. It might mean loving someone through their destructive behaviors, maybe practicing tough love and loving them from afar. Or it might mean absolutely being with them through their destructive behaviors. You're led to know the difference. But unconditional love, the point is, has nothing to do with actions and everything to do with consciousness, with what is in our minds. Fox says, the thing that really matters is to be merciful in your thoughts. Now, sitting on that mountaintop, the disciples, hearing the words of Jesus, would have understood that this beatitude, like many of the others, was sort of a secret, indirect attack on the Pharisees and Sadducees of the day for their hypocrisy and their attitudes of superiority. They clearly thought they were better than the Gentiles, women, Samaritans, anyone unlike themselves, and especially anyone who did not practice the Jewish faith. Now, it's entertaining for us to beat up on the Pharisees, isn't it? And it's kind of fun. However, if we follow Charles Fillmore's advice that every single character in the Bible can show us something about our own souls, then we're called to ask ourselves, how are we like the Pharisees, and what can we learn from them about our own soul's growth? Well, maybe the lesson is that unconditional love means not just loving people who look like us, think like us, and worship like us. It means to be merciful in our judgments of all humankind. For as Fox writes, in truth we are all one. And the more deeply someone seems to be in error, the more urgent it is the need for us to hold the right thought. I remember as a classroom teacher, I had a little worn-out 3x5 note card. Every year I ripped it off my plan book and stapled it onto the new one, and it said, remember, those who are the least lovable need your love the most. And that is so true. It's true with kids, and it's true with adults. So what does this mean? This means we are called upon to have unconditional love when people in our lives, our country, the world mess up. We need to remember that Christ in them is calling out to us to send them thoughts of love and acceptance, even though we might not approve of the actions, and there are no exceptions. Holding hatred resentment, negative judgments, blocking anything less than love, just really blocks the divine connection. God doesn't put up a barrier, but that becomes a barrier to us. You can't really be connected with God unless you can feel the divine love that God is. So in Proverbs we read, life is lived from within out. So guard your heart. Guard your heart. If we want to be loved, we must love. If we want peace, we must be peaceful. If we want healing, we must embrace wholeness. That is the divine law. And Eric Butterworth writes, in this beatitude, Jesus emphasizes that what comes to you is what is already in your consciousness. You may not like what you see in the world, but if you can see it differently, it makes a difference. Jesus later said, love your enemies and pray for those that despitefully use you, not just for them, not just for the benefit of the other person, but because you will take a step up in consciousness. The proverb says, Matthew says actually, you will be acting as true children of your Father in heaven. And so Butterworth writes, the wonderful corollary of this law is when we build a consciousness of love and justice and peace, we no longer look for or identify any apparent enmity or injustice in others. We draw ourselves to the best in other people, and we draw the best in others right back to us. So we might say that this one means, congratulations to you who love others unconditionally, for your life will be one of love, harmony, and peace. And so in all three of these Beatitudes today, Jesus is teaching that when we release human struggle and surrender to higher consciousness, when we let go and let God, when we hunger and thirst for right thinking, when we practice unconditional love in ourselves and others, then what needs to be healed in our lives will be healed, insights will be revealed, and we will dwell in the kingdom of heaven, not in some future time, but here and now. And so when we can look at one another and say, congratulations, let's do that now. Make eye contact with somebody in the sanctuary and say, congratulations, let's do it. Congratulations. Find another person. Congratulations. One more time, a third person, congratulations, okay? And so it is, and so Jesus meant it to be in his preamble to the Sermon on the Mount. So now we're going to take some time as we prepare for prayer and meditation to affirm the great truth about our God that Jesus taught us. And let's do this together, and for those of you who are here for the first time, this is printed in your bulletin. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.